This is Latin Pulse, a weekly analysis of news and public affairs in Latin America. Brought to you in cooperation with American University's School of Communication in Washington, D.C. and Link TV. And now here's host, Rick Rockwell.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Latin Pulse. This week, voters in Venezuela will be making some big decisions as controversial President Hugo Chavez stands for re-election. We'll have two contrasting views of Chavez and the elections as we focus most of our program on Venezuela. But first, Kurt Devine is here with this week's review of news from around Latin America.
Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos publicly appeared in good condition after undergoing prostate surgery shortly after announcing his illness to the media. Santos said he was recovering well, working from his hospital room, and will not need chemotherapy. The announcement of cancer came at a critical time in Santos' presidency, as he is preparing to start peace talks with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, a Marxist rebel group. Juan Carlos Hidalgo at the Cato Institute says the health of both Santos and his vice president, Angelina Garzón, could be a concern.
And the question is, what will happen in case of if both Santos and Garzón, the vice president, are incapacitated, at least temporarily? And apparently there is a minister that will take over.
Garzón suffered a stroke this past summer. We'll hear more from Hidalgo about the Colombian peace negotiations next week on this program. The American government contractor Alan Gross, jailed in Cuba for state crimes, may have an untreated cancerous tumor. That news coming this week from his wife and attorney. Gross's lawyer said the unidentified mass behind his right shoulder could be life-threatening. A Cuban court sentenced Gross to 15 years in prison last year on espionage charges. Gross said he was bringing satellite phones and computer equipment to Cuba's Jewish community. While working for the U.S. Agency for International Development, Gross is 63 years old. Last month, Cuban officials said they're willing to negotiate releasing Gross in exchange for five Cuban spies, four of whom remain in U.S. prisons. Cuban officials reject the claims that Gross is in ill health. Two U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents were shot on patrol by criminals near the border town of Naco, Arizona, known as a popular checkpoint for smugglers. Agent Nicholas Ivy died at the scene, and another agent survived after being airlifted to a hospital. A third agent was not injured. Mexican troops arrested two men suspected of involvement in the killings while responding to a tripped ground sensor in the city of Agua Prieta in northern Mexico. Venezuelan protesters killed a supporter of Enrique Capriles Rondosky, the candidate opposing President Hugo Chavez in this weekend's election. The slain supporter, Jason Valero, had taken a break from his trucking job to work full-time on the opposing candidate's campaign. He was shot at a road blocked by supporters of President Chavez, who were protesting against the Capriles campaign. Valero's death marks the second murder of one of Capriles' supporters, igniting more national tension in the already heated campaign. President Chavez called the violence a confrontation, but opposition supporters call it a blatant attack. We'll have more about the Venezuelan elections coming up next. For Latin Pulse, I'm Kurt Devine.
Thanks, Kurt. We begin our special focus on Venezuela with Carlos Laria of the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. That organization released a report on the Chavez government and Venezuela last month. Laria talked to us from his organization's offices in New York City via Skype.
Our conclusion is that, you know, while the administration of President Chavez transformed almost every aspect of Venezuela's political culture, it was indeed the media that perhaps suffered the largest transformation. And it is clear that, you know, after the use of an array of legislation, the use of regulatory measures, threats, campaigns of harassment, the independent press in Venezuela, the private press, has really taken a hit and is now debilitated. At the same time, after the failed attempt coup of April of 2002, The administration of President Chavez realized that in order to challenge the influence of private media at that time, dominant media, especially in the audiovisual broadcast sector, the administration needed to heavily invest on state media. And that was the goal, to build a state media apparatus that will challenge the influence of private media, and they have done so very successfully. But the result is that this network of state broadcasters, print media, and also digital outlets are used mainly to broadcast propaganda and also as a platform to launch attacks and promote investigations on members of the opposition and on journalists that oppose the views of the administration.
Let's go back to the 2002 coup, because you brought that up. Many people linked various media outlets, particularly very powerful television networks, with helping to plot that particular coup. Is this not just a natural reaction against private media that may have gone beyond the ethical bounds?
Right. Well, you know, that has been widely documented in terms of what was the role of the media during that period, right? And, you know, there's evidence that shows that while people in the streets were calling for Chavez to be back in power in April of 2002, you know, massive demonstrations, the main television stations were broadcasting cartoons. I think that the lack of credibility of political parties, and this is a phenomenon that not only took place in Venezuela but in many other Latin American countries, produced a vacuum that in Venezuela was filled by the media, the main broadcasters, and mainly mostly were decisions taken by the media owners at that time, right, that decided to jump into the political arena and, you know, promoting the agenda of the opposition. I mean, but you know, it was clear that since then the government has reacted with a spirit of revenge. And you know, and since then, there is a decision from the president down to control the flow of information, to minimize the influence of the press, and stifle, repress critical coverage.
We still see that we have these large networks like Venevisión and powerful newspapers like Tal Cual sometimes taking positions against the government. And I suppose the more important television network would be the all-news information Globovisión in Venezuela. Are they not enough of a balance to this, what you characterize as propaganda?
I mean, the... If you see how the networks, you know, what's the network coverage now? I mean, the only critical broadcaster, really critical broadcaster, that remains is Globovisión, and you have to understand, Rick, that Globovisión only broadcasts to a small portion of the population. Only broadcasts to Caracas and the state of Carabobo on the air. I mean, then it goes to cable and satellite the rest of the country. But you know, that's limited in Venezuela in terms of reach. I mean, since the passage of the law on social responsibility in radio and television, called the content law by journalists in Venezuela in 2005, most of the networks that were critical of the government needed to cut their most critical talk shows, the most controversial shows, in order to comply with the law. A law that, according to international human rights organizations and even the special rapporteur on freedom of expression of the OAS, violated inter-American standards in terms of freedom of expression. So, you know, RCTV, the main critical outlet network, right, broadcaster, you know, continued to do criticism despite the law. And, you know, in 2007 was taken off the air. Decision by the government not to renew its license was, you know, the beginning of, you know, of a situation where dozens of radio stations, also private, also critical, were also taking off the air. You know, the case of RCTV was vastly and widely documented. It was a decision taken by the government in order to take off the air the main opposition channel, the main critical channel that broadcast across the country. Had been in the air for more than 50 years. And it was clearly a decision where the government said, repeated before the decision was taken, that RCTV had violated the Constitution, the telecommunications law, the law on social responsibility in radio and television, that it broadcast propaganda, it broadcast pornography. But there was no clear, transparent, impartial process where RCTV would be able to defend its case in a neutral venue. So there was no judicial sentence against RCTV. Are people being deprived of information that is important? Of course. And I think that's one of the things that we believe you know, are critical for Venezuelans in the weeks that lead up to the elections. And Rick, it's important also to note that you know, there's been a grave crisis in the prison system with dozens of people dead. The undermining of the institutions of democracy in Venezuela, right, with you know, the erosion of the division of powers, you know, the well-documented interference of the executive in the judiciary, is clearly undermining you know, this situation. And I mean, the failure of the Chavez administration to support independent institutions has the potential to undermine the legitimacy of the elections. But I think that the main conclusion of this report is, whoever wins the next election, rolling back a decade of media repression and fostering a climate of dialogue and tolerance where the press can do its work without pressure, intimidation, and government interference, is one of the key challenges for the next administration.
Well, thank you, Carlos Laria of the Committee to Protect Journalists, joining us today on Latin Pulse.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
And now, an addendum to our interview. We should also note that the Venezuelan government fined the critical television network Globovision more than $2 million this summer. Free speech advocates condemned the fine as chilling the atmosphere for criticism leading up to the elections.
I want to finish
school
and then go to
college
to be able to
graduate
and have
the future
my parents couldn't have, because I know that
going to college
is the best thing I can do for my
future. The words of a parent help to build the future of a child. The Hispanic Scholarship Fund has the information to help your kids go to college. Visit yourwordstoday.org or call 1-877-HSF-8711. Sponsored by the Hispanic Scholarship Fund and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Latin Pulse. President Chavez squares off against his leading opponent, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, at the polls this weekend. We discussed elections in Venezuela with Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research just before he traveled to Caracas to observe the voting.
In the past 14 years that the Chavez government has been in charge, some would say there have been more elections or plebiscites, more chances for people to go to the polls in Venezuela than just about any country in Latin America.
Well, yes, some people think it's even a bit excessive. There's been a national election nearly every year between the legislative elections, the regional and municipal elections, and then various referendums that have had to do with changing the constitution in Venezuela and the renewal, the indefinite renewal of the presidential mandate. There have been elections nearly every year. And what's really quite amazing is that people in Venezuela don't seem to grow tired of them. And participation has remained very high in these elections.
These elections don't seem to be very close. Latest polls have President Chavez up by more than 10 points, although polling in Venezuela by itself is a fairly controversial subject. Anything to say about this race in particular or about the polls?
Well, I think what we can say is that this is probably a closer race, and we'll probably see closer results, a tighter race than was the case in the previous presidential elections, in which President Chavez was pitted against Manuel Rosales, the former governor of Zulia. There was a very, very wide spread between the two candidates then. And here it seems that partly through a very well-organized opposition campaign, I think probably a very effective opposition campaign, there's likely to be more important mobilization in favor of the opposition candidate, Enrique Capriles. And so we can expect a tighter race. There are very few polls, and the polling, you know, as you suggested, has been a little bit all over the place, but there are very few that suggest that Enrique Capriles could win. There's one in particular, Consultores 21, Consultores 21, that has predicted that he will win. However, nearly all the other polls predict Chavez win, and some of them predict a win with a very, very large margin of 10 points or more.
Aren't the polls suspect in Venezuela? Aren't they more polarized and partisan than we see in other countries?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, we do see polarized, certainly partisan polling, I think, all over Latin America. I don't think Venezuela is atypical in that regard. You know, there have been a number of studies done on the polling this time around where individual pollsters, based on their track record in the past, have had sort of ponderated biases. And so their forecasts have been adjusted. And, you know, when this has been done, it still shows a pretty probable win for President Chavez.
Capriles has seemed to have latched on lately to this idea of following more of a Brazilian model of being a progressive leftist. That sort of rhetoric seems to have entered the campaign fairly late. Is there really any philosophical or content to this election, or is this merely a referendum on Chavez and his administration of the country?
You know, I think more than anything, this is a referendum on Chavez. That's certainly been the case of many of the previous elections. The opposition candidate and the sort of united opposition, they've come up with a common agenda. And what's interesting to see is that their public agenda, certainly, indicates that they would preserve a lot of the policies that President Chavez has implemented, in particular the social mission. So they merely speak of rendering these missions more efficient. But it's a big change from the discourse of a number of years ago when they spoke of doing away with these missions altogether. But there's been a lot of talk of a sort of a clandestine program from the opposition. In fact, there was a document that was leaked that caused quite a bit of controversy within the ranks of the opposition itself. This document, and it's not possible at this point to authentic to gauge whether it's authentic. However, it calls for the privatization, essentially, of a lot of the missions and of various social policies, including the social security system and so on, and also a big turnaround in the running of the oil company of Venezuela. And this is something that seems to be very much rejected by most of the population. And when rumors came out that this was, in fact, the clandestine program of the opposition, there are a few prominent members of the opposition that broke ranks, and this happened just a few weeks ago.
Let's talk a little bit more about this, because President Chavez doesn't buy this new left image that Capriles is trying to sell to the electorate, and has pointed out that he comes from a rich family, that he will really represent the old elites and oligarchy of Venezuela.
Well, certainly, and he does come from a very rich family, contrary to Lula, and he has mentioned Lula as a model. Lula, of course, came from a very, very poor family in Brazil, never got a high school education, and was a worker in a factory, and then a union leader before becoming president. So very different trajectories. Enrique Capriles certainly was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He went to Harvard in the United States and was one of the founders of a party called Primero Justicia in the late 90s, a party that that emerged in the sort of upper-class neighborhoods of Caracas. And their first victories were in those neighborhoods, in those municipalities, particularly the municipalities of Chacao and Baruta in eastern Caracas. And certainly their base for quite a long time consisted of wealthy members of the elite within Caracas. They didn't even have really a regional base. And then they began to expand in the last few years. But there's a lot of questioning of, you know, really their sincerity when they talk of when they have a program that, you know, basically replicates that of Chavez in many points. And, you know, the other worrying factor is that none of the main leaders of the opposition, including Enrique Capriles himself, have said clearly that they will respect the results of the elections, even if it is their defeat. So these are some worrying signs that they may be preparing to not recognize the elections, and it'll be interesting to see if that is the case, whether they have support really within the country, within the country's military, for instance, and internationally as well. And it'll be interesting to see how the United States government reacts.
What's your prediction in that regard if President Chavez wins yet another re-election?
Well, you know, my prediction at this point, my impression is that President Obama at this point in his campaign certainly doesn't want to deal with a foreign policy crisis. That's the sort of thing that you really try to avoid in the last few weeks of a campaign like this. Because of that, I think it's fairly unlikely that his administration would support the opposition if they were to reject the results of the election. I think that's really quite unlikely at this point. But, you never know, really. There are certainly sectors within the United States government, within the U.S. State Department, and so on, that remain very, very hostile to the current Venezuelan government, and that I think, you know, would push for supporting the opposition no matter what. So that's something to be on the lookout for.
Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, thank you for joining us today on Latin Pulse.
Thank you.
And now, Latin American Perspectives with Peter Hakam of the Inter-American Dialogue.
For several years now, Mexico has been going through a rough period. Since President Felipe Calderón took office in 2006, more than 60,000 Mexicans have been killed in the drug-fueled violence that has engulfed many parts of the country. Mexico's oil production, which finances more than 30% of the national budget, is slumping. And in 2009, the economy contracted by some 6.5%. No other country in Latin America suffered a bigger blow from the global financial crisis. But as Mexico approaches the December 1st inauguration of newly elected President Enrique Peña Nieto, things are looking up. One reason is the economy, which has been growing at a healthy 4.5% pace for nearly 3 years. But there's also a strong sense of optimism that the new government will succeed in introducing reforms needed to achieve steady economic and social advance. Sure, that may simply be the hope that is often placed in new leadership. A new broom is expected to sweep cleaner. But Mexicans also have tangible grounds for their optimism, even if it should be accompanied by a measure of skepticism. First of all, there is relatively broad agreement on what the priorities of the soon-to-be-installed government should be. The agenda includes updating labor legislation, which is already near approval, revamping the nation's energy policies, and freeing its national oil company from many suffocating constraints, and reshaping the country's tax and spending policies. In addition, the new president has to get control of the rampant crime and bloodletting and initiate a serious assault on pervasive corruption. A second reason for optimism is that this agenda for reform is supported by the two largest parties in the legislature. Together, they have a significant congressional majority and now appear as likely allies for the coming year. They may even be able to draw sufficient votes from smaller parties to enact some desirable constitutional changes. Third, new President Peña Nieto is regarded as an exceptionally talented politician, not a visionary, but rather a pragmatic leader who knows what can and cannot get done, and he has the skills to keep his own party in line and build coalitions with others, and also make the necessary trade-offs. There is one area, improved security and safety, in which optimism appears less warranted. Mexican expectations for improvement seem largely based on the belief that the situation is so bad today that it has to get better. But no one seems really to have a strategy to produce any better results. Still, all said, there are reasons to be upbeat about Mexico. The most important is that Mexicans seem to agree more than they disagree on what needs to get done. That is a big difference from the United States.
Peter Hakam's opinions are his own and not the official opinions of this program. If you'd like to react to Latin American Perspectives or any portion of this program, you may write us. You can find us at latinpulse@gmx.com. That's latinpulse, all one word, @gmx.com. Or you may leave us a message online via SoundCloud or on Facebook. Latin Pulse is available on the web and via iTunes. To see the Latin Pulse archives of video programs on Latin America, you can check out Link TV's website, www.linktv, all one word, .org, and then /Latin Pulse, also all one word. That's www.linktv.org/Latin Pulse. Thank you for joining us this week on Latin Pulse. For our entire team, associate producer Kurt Devine, announcer Victor Kilo, and writer Colin Campbell, I'm Rick Rockwell. Escucha nosotros, gracias por su tiempo.
Latin Pulse is produced in Washington, D.C. at American University's School of Communication with the support of Link TV. Theme music provided by Link TV and additional music from Canary Productions and Bath Time Music Publishing. This program is copyright 2012 Las Rocas Productions.